Is this on? Not yet. Oh, that's on. Is it on now? Okay. Let me say thank you to the three organizers, Oleg, Yoji, and Yun, for doing this. Bruce is, and thank you to Bruce for becoming 60. Bruce is certainly one of the central people in Canada in algebra and Lie theory, and many of us know him and appreciate him over the years this way, and it's just great to be part of a celebration of his birthday. So what I want to talk about today is, as the title indicates, conjugate results for the Lie algebra SL2 over an algebra, which is a UFD. This is joint work with June Morita, and it's on the web. I've given you the number there. And I'll say a bit more about this as I get into the talk, but what stimulated us to begin thinking about this was some recent and what I think of is fairly spectacular results of Arturo Pianzola on conjugacy type results for certain kinds of toroidal algebras. And he did his results, it's because of the development in root graded algebras and EALAs that these questions became natural to consider. And he considered them from a geometric technically, at least for me, quite difficult viewpoint. And what June Morita and I set out to do, at least for SL2, it's maybe not feasible to do for many algebras more than SL2, is to really try to understand conjugacy in a hands-on fashion. And so we wanted to do this in as elementary a way as we could, and we also wanted to do this in a way that was characteristic free of the base field. So Arturo's work needed characteristic zero, and so that maybe sets the stage for what I want to talk about. So we're going to let F be a general field of characteristic different than 2. And I want to assume that R is always a unital, commutative, associative F algebra. So I can identify F inside of R. R cross is going to be the units of R. And then, of course, SL2 of R is just the trace zero matrices. So R is commutative. We don't have to worry about any non-commutativity there. That's an F subspace of the full matrix algebra, of course. And if R is an integral domain for notation, I'm going to let K be the quotient field. And then we have SL2R, this Lie algebra that's infinite dimensional over F, possibly, squeezed between two copies of SL2, but over different fields. And the analog for a Cartan subalgebra, I'll come to describing it a little more later on, is this subalgebra, one-dimensional subalgebra H, just the F-span of the usual little h. And I've recalled what the definition of an SL2 triple is. I'm sure most people in the room know what an SL2 triple is. And it's easy to see that if you want to play with SL2 triples, then if you have one, E, H, and F, so I'm putting the H in the middle, then F minus H and E is also an SL2 triple. And if I have an SL2 triple, and I can use the transpose, so if my elements are matrices, then Y transpose, H transpose, and X transpose are also going to be an SL2 triple. So you can pass from one kind of triple to another. And for notation, the notation. I want to label matrices as if they're elements in a three-dimensional space. So X will be capital X1, X2, X3, minus X1 on the diagonal, the same for H and Y. And the first lemma that one would want to prove in this kind of a study, at least to us, was that there are certain arithmetic or kind of numerical results on the entries of a matrix if X, H, and Y are in an SL2 triple in that way. And so the first lemma describes that. In particular, this condition 4 is turns out to be fairly important for the rest of the investigation. The lemma itself is very straightforward to prove. It's just you put your head down and compute. You have to combine the right elements and so on, but you do that. And so then the next result is that, in fact, if you have a unique factorization domain, and this became easily our most interesting kind of ring to use this on, then if you have one of these elements, H, satisfying that its square is the identity, you could always complement H by finding an X and a Y to get an SL2 triple. So you could always place it within an SL2 triple. And I want to go over the proof of this with you. Again, almost everything we do in this paper doesn't use a lot of machinery, but we found you have to compute the right thing at the right time. And here the computation, I want to show you where the UFD property comes in and how we used it. The computation isn't just an existence proof, it's hands-on, so we actually produce elements that give the SL2 triple. So the proof begins by saying, well, if one of the entries, H2 or H3, we picked H2, is 0, then it follows from the equation that we're assuming about H that the other H1 is plus or minus 1. In the case that it's plus 1, we can write down two matrices that work, and the same when it's minus 1. And so you just solve the appropriate conditions and see where it leads you, essentially. This is, again, fairly straightforward, as is, I mean, the case when H3 is 0. So the next thing to do is to suppose that maybe I'll show it to you like this, try to tease you a little bit. You go to the next case where H2 and H3 are not 0. That means H1 is not plus or minus 1. And what should I write next? I mean, because R is a UFD, does anyone have any idea what you should do with these elements? Well, we didn't at the beginning. And it's not obvious, actually, what one should do, and you play around with it and see. So I think what I'm trying to say is, and show you, you really have to use the UFD property, and it's not totally apparent at the beginning what you should look for from there. But then, well, what we found worked was we need to understand that we can factor the elements in this way. And it's not hard to see once you have a UFD that you can do that. And we came to that. So at first we were trying to work more generally than a UFD, but we came to that because in this situation we could then write down what I've called here two matrices in terms of what elements we were given in the H. So we can actually solve for some things. This isn't quite yet an SL2 triple, but it's well on the way. And we could do that in terms of the single element we've been given, in a polynomial fashion, in fact. I mean, this, this probably has some consequences. So this means what we have is non-zero elements inside of this quotient field SL2K. Well, they're non-zero and they're in SL2R that satisfy some of the right conditions. And that says that SL2K now has an eigenspace decomposition relative to H. So we've had to work upstairs to see this. And now we can choose X and Y, as I've written there. And because of the factorization properties that we have from up above, it's not too hard to see that X and Y, in fact, satisfy this miracle of being in SL2R. So we've actually found elements in SL2R downstairs now that satisfy the right properties. So this gives us our SL2 triple. So what can we do with this? Well, we can prove our first conjugacy kind of result. So recall that GL2 is just the group of GL2R is group of 2x2 invertible matrices with entries from R, so it means the determinant is a unit, and if I have such an element, then conjugation by it, of course, is an automorphism of SL2, R, the Lie algebra. And so what we can say in the next result is that if R is a UFD, then if I have an element H satisfying H squared as the identity, then I can conjugate it by something in GL2R to get this element 1 minus 1 on the diagonal. So all such elements are conjugate to this one. What kinds of things Arturo was interested? I guess first I want to say the proof of this is very similar to the proof that I just showed you of the second result, and we can actually write down explicitly what the P is that's doing the conjugation. So I want to explain what a MAD is. So we want to work with abelian subalgebras. So these are the subalgebras that Arturo worked with, and indeed in the setting we're in, these are the proper kind of replacements for what one thinks of as Cartan subalgebras. So it's an abelian subalgebra of SL2R that's ad-diagonalizable, and that means it's diagonalizable over F for all elements in there. And when that's the case, well, you can then get an eigenspace decomposition, as I've written, and you need a maximality. So if you look at the family of all such abelian ad-diagonalizable subalgebras, you call those among them maximal abelian ad-diagonalizable, or MADS for short, if it's maximal with respect to inclusion. So what we can prove in this setting, and this is the result that Arturo can prove in a slightly different setting in characteristic zero. He's working differently than just SL2. He's working for all finite dimensional simple Lie algebras. And, in some cases, well, a different setup with the ring is required. But in our case, if R is a UFD, if H prime is one of these maximal abelian diagonalizable subalgebras, then its dimension over F has to be 1, and its conjugate by an element in GL2R to the H we all know and love. So that's what the result says. And again, I just want to show you pieces of the proof, so I'll try to outline some of the steps in the proof. To show you how some different ideas come into this. The first step is sort of interesting. If you have any old element whatsoever, z in SL2R, either its square is 0, so add z to the third is 0, and hence add z is nilpotent, or you can conjugate it by a diagonal, an element in GL2 of what I've called K bar. K bar is the algebraic closure of the quotient field. So you need enough eigenvalues, but if you go up to the algebraic closure, you have them. Then you get a diagonal matrix with a non-zero entry on the diagonal. Step two says then if we have maximal abelian ad diagonalizable subalgebra, and we have a non-zero element H prime in there, then we can conjugate it to become a non-zero diagonal element over the algebraic closure. And so that means it has eigenvalues 2 times lambda and minus 2 times lambda. Lambda is just some element in the algebraic closure of the quotient field of our UFD. And so then we look what that means. We have a MAD, and so this element H prime is diagonalizable over F. That's part of the hypothesis of being a MAD. And so it means that we can write SL2R as a bunch of eigenspaces. These are these FVIs, and it gives some eigenvalues, mu I, I've called them, but in particular, the mu I's have to be 0, 2 lambda, or minus 2 lambda, because eigenvalues are eigenvalues. And they can't all be equal to 0, because H prime wasn't 0, so that means you can get out of this that lambda actually fell down to the ring where you want to be in the first place. So you can go up, but you can also come down. So in step three, then, we sort of put this together and use previous results. And we say, well, pick another element, H double prime. That's also in SL2R because lambda was in F. And its square happens to be the identity now. And that's because the square of H prime was lambda squared. And so we can conjugate it by an element in GL2R to come to our favorite element. And so that means we could conjugate the H prime to give us lambda. And then we simply follow that around, essentially saying we follow that around is proving that the H that we look at already is a MAD. So I won't say much more about this argument here. I'll put it there for your perusal. But we get that H equals H double prime, and hence what we have is the H prime that we chose to be an arbitrary MAD has dimension 1 and can be conjugated by an element we can actually write down if we knew an element in H prime that was non-zero into our H. So this is an elementary proof of conjugacy in this special case of SL2 over a unique factorization domain, which is an algebra over K, which is not of characteristic 2. So what good is this result? Well, we can use it to say what the automorphisms are. So I want to say a little bit about automorphisms. And if I have an automorphism of the base ring R, then it acts on SL2R just by entry-wise acting. And it's clear the action then gives an injection between this automorphism group and the automorphisms of SL2R. So I want to consider it as a subgroup of the automorphisms of SL2R. And if I have an element in GL2R, we've already said it induces an automorphism on SL2R. And if I have two and they differ by a unit in R, then they act the same. I call the action tau sub p if p is the element. And so it's easy to see that the center of GL2 is just the scalars times the identity, where the scalar is a unit, and the corresponding factor group, of course, is PGL2R. And so that also can be embedded in the automorphism group. So that embeds into the automorphism group of SL2R, and the kernel is just the center, so I get an embedding of PGL2, and this subgroup is in fact normalized by the action of the automorphisms of R, and so what we have is a semi-direct product, is what the next result says, that the full automorphism group is just the semi-direct product of PGL2R and the automorphisms of R. So the proof just uses some of the previous results and some fairly standard computations. And this is, I might point out, one of the prime interests that one is interested in conjugacy results. It allows you to see what the automorphisms are going to be and really get your hands on them. What about conjugation of SL2 triples? Well, here we don't need the UFD property. So this is a result that holds just for a general integral domain. If you have an SL2 triple in SL2R, then you can prove that there's some automorphism that conjugates your given triple into the usual one. Okay, you don't need any special properties. However, if you have a special property, namely if R is a UFD, then you do know the shape of the automorphism group, and moreover, you can say the conjugating automorphism comes from PGL2R inside, so you can give more information. And let me just show you a little bit about the proof of this. So for the first part, I want to deal with the case where there's no assumption on the ring except that it's an integral domain. Write down our three matrices in the usual way. And I want to write them as triples now, so I want a kind of three-dimensional space. And use this to define this map theta that I've indicated up there from SL2R to itself, where we take our triple and make this 3x3 matrix B with it and let it act that way. And so, I mean, here's just another way of denoting what the image is. And theta then can clearly be extended to a k-linear map, again called theta. And we're going to do the same kind of trick. We're going to consider the eigenvalues at H, and that gives us that these three elements, X, H, and Y, are linearly independent, in fact, over K, so that the image of theta is three-dimensional, so it has to be all of SL2K, so that means theta is an automorphism. And we can compute the determinant of this matrix B, and again, we need to refer to lemma 1, and it's not directly, it's some little tricky place in the proof of that lemma where we get to see that this means B has unit determinant, and so is in GL3R. And that's enough to then tell us that that theta actually does the right thing. It maps this theta inverse maps this copy inside of this. So it gives us that the R span of X, H, and Y is all SL2R. So theta gives an automorphism of SL2R as a Lie algebra over F, and so theta inverse is actually the desired conjugating automorphism. So it was a little novel to us that we went to a three-dimensional setting. The proof of the second part, again, we need to use the UFD property, and it's similar to what we've learned before in Theorem 2, so I won't say much more about that. For the next result, I need to make a remark first, and the remark something that's pretty straightforward and easy, but worth remarking. If we just have a commutative associative F algebra with identity, then there's a one-to-one correspondence between the lattice of ideals of R and the lattice of ideals of the Lie algebra SL2R, and I've written down what the correspondence is. So the theorem says, well, suppose we have an integral domain, not necessarily a UFD, and we have a non-zero element in SL2R. The question is, when is it part of an SL2 triple? So that's the second condition here, when it's the first element of an SL2 triple, or equivalently the third element. When at X is nilpotent, together with this condition that the ideal generated by X2 and X3, two elements from within the matrix, gives you the whole ring. So this condition has to be there, and at the same time, then there's an automorphism of SL2R that conjugates this into 0, 1, 0, 0. And when we do have the UFD condition, then we can say a bit more, namely that x1 squared plus x2 x3 equals 0, and the sum of these two ideals is all of R, then we can actually say there's an element in GL2R that conjugates Rx into the usual element, 0, 1, 0, 0. So then we got a little more curious, and we wanted to answer when an element of SL2R belongs to a subalgebra of SL2R, which is isomorphic to SL2F. So what is the union of all the spans of SL2 triples look like? And the next result says that. Suppose R is a UFD and F is square root closed. So this was a condition we worked on and tried to banish, but couldn't easily. And take any old non-zero element of SL2R. The following conditions are equivalent. It lies in a subalgebra A, isomorphic to SL2F. The second condition is just on the entries of the matrix, Z1 squared plus Z2, Z3 equals 0. This is from lemma 1, plus this condition on ideals, or otherwise, such an element, Z1 squared plus Z2, Z3, is just a non-zero element in the base field. Of course, you expect the base field to show up someplace in your conclusion, because you're talking about that. Finally, two quick things that I just want to mention that seem to be known about SL2R. One is that you might ask, when an SL2R is isomorphic to an SL2S as we algebras are an S commutative, one of them being an integral domain, then the two coordinate rings should be isomorphic. And the second result, which follows from Saeed's talk this morning, so it's about derivations of SL2R, and well, I've written it in a way that was different from the way Saeed wrote it, but it actually follows from Bloch's result way back when, 1968, I guess. If you look at the derivations, then you have inner derivations, which of course form an ideal, and then you have derivations of the ring that act and so can be considered inside the derivation algebra of the Lie algebra, and then what you get as it is a semi-direct sum of these two give you the derivations of SL2R. So this is a good place to stop.